Agriculture Policy Committee will come to order. We have the clerk will check the roll. The minutes of the previous meeting are here. Representative Demmer, would you care to move the minutes?
Yes, Mr.
Chairman. Representative Demmer moves the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. The first bill we're going to take up today is House File 2229 by Representative Junkie.
Do what?
Representative Junkie. Well,
I'd move House
your
file,
committee and
I'd move House File 2229, and where do you want to send it? Either to Representative Harder or Staines Committee, I would assume, and it doesn't matter to me one way or another.
I probably to the Ag Finance Committee.
That's fine. Then I would move that 229 be recommended pass and go to Ag Finance. And let me just briefly, introduction, members, this bill, I opened the paper about a month ago, and February 13th to be exact, and in the St. Paul paper, a headline caught me. I read the first line, flip a light switch in five or ten years, and there's a fair chance the electricity that flows through your lamp will arrive courtesy of a Minnesota staple, corn. And when I see that, I kept reading, and I got excited, because members, what we have is and I have with me a guest who's going to explain it, but what we're doing is we've actually figured out we can actually turn ethanol into hydrogen, which then can be put in a fuel cell and generate electricity. So literally our municipal utility plants, city by city around the state, could be actually burning our corn to produce electricity. And I thought, as an introduction, number one, I know this committee wants to further that exploration and research as rapidly as we can and help it out. But number two, I think for information today, I've brought in Dr. Lanny Schmidt from the Department of Chemical Engineering, Institute of Technology at my alma mater, the University of Minnesota. And I'd like to have him spend 5 or 10 minutes with you explaining what he's up to and answer any of your questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Schmidt, welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I am Lanny Schmidt. I'm a Regents Professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Chemical Engineering and Material Science, which is in the Institute of Technology. And so I'd like to spend just 5 or 10 minutes talking about renewable energy and chemicals for Minnesota. Just the article that was referred to, I'll show this first. We made the banner headlines, which was rather amazing. It must have been a quiet news day in the Pioneer Press. So there was that. But by the way, the same day, the Pioneer Press had Dilbert on February 13th, and it says here, you made the cover of Morons on Parade. I hope they didn't misquote me, so I look like a moron. Writers do that. Phew, all the quotes are accurate. So I made the press, and so far I think all the quotes are fairly accurate. So let's talk about renewable energy and chemicals. We all agree that sometime we're going to switch from fossil fuels, petroleum, coal, gas, to renewable sources. They are sustainable. They're not imported. They're distributed. They make no carbon dioxide. No greenhouse gases, none of that stuff, and they cause less pollution. Someday this will happen, and everybody agrees these are all good things. No one really questions that. The next question is when. Could be 5 years, and it could be 50 years. And as usual about the future, nobody knows what's going to happen. And the question that is prominent in this issue is, what are the sources of renewable energy, and what technologies will happen? Well, what I'm going to tell you is, I think you know this, corn and soybeans are the current sources. Switchgrass and hybrid poplar and things may be future sources. And technologies like the one we're talking about are possible things. just say, you've all heard about the hydrogen economy. The president put it in last year's State of the Union, State of the Union address. The hydrogen economy is a code word for fuel cells, which need hydrogen. And one of the virtues of this is the third point I've got there, distributed energy. Right now, we've got a small number of power plants around the state and big power lines, high voltage lines running around. We're not going to build any more of those. The idea of going back towards distributed energy, having each county or each district have its own power plant without all of the big grid, has all kinds of things that would be good. Nothing is gained in the hydrogen economy if we stick with fossil fuels. There's no point. The hydrogen economy only makes sense if we have renewable fuels, because we don't stop the global warming problem, and we don't really get increased efficiency if we continue to use fossil fuels. The constraints here is you need an available resource. You've got to have something to get the energy from. You need a supply infrastructure. You can't build a new set of pipelines or power plant or electric lines or something. You want it distributed. You don't want it centralized, and you want it to be cheap. You have to. You can't pay much more for it. There's two candidates to do this. One is ethanol, and one is soybeans. And these are the only two candidates on the horizon that I think technology can't think of much else. And if you look at these, they're really not bad. Ethanol, there are some subsidies here, of course, but ethanol is available for maybe $1.10. I think it's up to $1.30, $1.40 a gallon. Soy oil is the other candidate. It's still pretty expensive because it's maxed out, first of all, but it's used for food. So, renewable energy for Minnesota. We have enough biomass to do the job. We could satisfy all of our energy needs. We have enough corn, actually, in Minnesota to replace most of our gasoline. Biodiesel could replace much of diesel. The other number that I still find mind-boggling, Minnesota spends $12 billion a year to import energy. That's a balance of payments deficit that the state has to import to import the energy we need. If you could make a couple billion dollar dent on that, you're doing some significant help to the state. And so that's the idea. Electricity from ethanol. I won't really get into it, but as you know, we now supply 10% of Minnesota's gasoline needs. We're exporting our Minnesota ethanol to California and the East Coast and so forth. We certainly have a surplus even now, and we're growing this. The ethanol supply is growing 20-30% a year, et cetera. We'll be doubling our ethanol production in just a few years. The sort of my last line down there is ethanol burning it is not maybe the smartest thing you could do. We're just pouring ethanol into our gas tanks and burning it. We get some pollution benefits, but it's not perhaps the optimal use of a valuable chemical. Why not use it for a fuel cell? In fact, the trick is here that fermentation is a very efficient process. Now I'll sound like a chemical engineer for just a second. But what fermentation does is to concentrate all the energy that came from sunlight that's in sugar and starch into ethanol, and it does it with no energy loss, and then you can make hydrogen. So that was the gist of what we did in our lab on the Minneapolis campus, et cetera, making hydrogen from ethanol. And the Pioneer Press editor, I didn't do this, he did, but it was a very good graphic to illustrate what's going on. On the left, you take corn, you ferment it. That first arrow makes ethanol, and then you pass that through an automotive fuel injector, mix it with a little bit of air and a little bit of heat, and the catalyst is shown there next to that. You make hydrogen, and that makes electricity. That's the gist of the process. By the way, the whole renewable thing needs to be mentioned. Ethanol, carbohydrates contain carbon, but there is no carbon dioxide produced. There's no greenhouse gases from ethanol or biodiesel, because all of the CO2 that you make from this process goes back into next year's corn or soybeans crop. So there's no carbon dioxide produced. The greenhouse effect is completely eliminated. We also, there's a lot of other research going on in my lab and other places on campus. One of the other ones is to use biodiesel. That's the other resource, and there's about a third as much bio. We make about a third as much soybeans as we do corn, and that's a major commodity. As you know, we're going to put 1% biodiesel into our diesel pool in 2005, I believe it is. But what we're working on is another process, just totally different, making polymers, making olefins out of biodiesel. And by the way, that's related to a very similar process you probably know about. Cargill Dow is using corn to make polylactic acid, which is a polyester. They'll be making milk bottles and clothing and all this kind of stuff out of that. So that's making chemicals out of renewable things. So you're not going to do this unless you're going to save money. And so just looking quickly at the economics, the prices of ethanol and biodiesel are a little higher than crude oil right now. The price of crude, who knows what sets the price of crude oil, and as you fill up your gas tank, it's going up fast. These prices are almost at parity. If our process worked very well, we could make electricity at about 4 cents a kilowatt hour, which is really highly competitive with that. Olefins are to make polymers. Olefins from biodiesel could also be economical. Finally, let me close off here by saying that the university has major programs and major plans that we want that we are initiating for renewable energy and the environment. This comes from a $20 million legislative mandate over 5 years for research on renewable energy and the environment. We are very thankful that Xcel funded this, but not entirely voluntarily, from SIP and RDF funds last year. And we're putting this together. It's been in place for about 9 months, and we've got 15-20 projects that we are starting in this area. The things we're trying to do in the university, we want this to be interdisciplinary, involving College of Agriculture, Biology, Technology, and policy issues. All the problems, you got to have all these aspects together. You go from planting corn to making high-tech polymers, et cetera, and you got to do this. And you got to do this right. We're now organizing this initiative in terms of four clusters. One is hydrogen. That's the thing I was talking about. The second one is efficiency. We're putting together a major coordinated program in building efficiency, city efficiency, trying to really use energy more wisely. A major program is bioproducts and bioenergy. That's mainly with agriculture and the biology departments, but there's a biodiesel program in our mechanical engineering department that interfaces with that. With policy and the environment, we really got to do this clean, because we're not going, you know, we've got to, along the way, do this cleaner than we're now doing with our petroleum-based economy. So, to finish then, ask, what do we need? Our goal is to build world-class programs in renewable energy in Minnesota. Since we are Minnesota, this will be based on biomass sources. Minnesota has both the resources and the talent to build major biomass systems. Somebody has said that the upper Midwest is the Saudi Arabia of biomass production. And that's a cool phrase. And I think it's true. We really have enough energy, we produce enough biomass to supply the whole country, basically. And the other aspect there on what we're trying to do with IRE is, we want to improve the rural economy. It's just kind of automatic that renewable energy comes from rural areas from throughout the state. And then you get the switchgrass and hybrid poplar, and you're even taking places that aren't agriculturally based right now. You're putting them in the mix. And so we're going to do this. Collaboration is essential in our goal. Collaboration within the university. I am talking with people over on the ag side, trying to figure out how you would increase corn production, and people in those departments deal with that. We really want to make this program work throughout the state. We have a major part of our program right now in Morris, and we have ideas of expanding to other outstate centers. The nonprofit institutions, organizations are very active in renewable energy, hydrogen. They come from many different backgrounds, but they want to do this. We've got to collaborate with state and federal government. That's why we hope you folks come into play here, because we've got to get $20 million over 5 years does not go very far. We've really got the leverage considerably. We want to build a world-class system for doing research and development in renewable energy. Our neighboring states, many of them are spending more than five times this amount. And we're hoping that this is the opening to really make Minnesota a world-class state in doing renewable energy and chemicals. So I thank you for the opportunity to make the case, and I'd be happy to answer questions or discussion.
Thank you. Is there questions? Representative Otto.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to be brief. I have two questions for you. I'm interested in this myself, and here are the two questions. I asked my constituents what they thought of doing further development as a state on hydrogen fuel cells, because I am very interested and I think it's a great way to go. Comments I've gotten from some folks is that if it's a viable industry, that private industry should develop it, not the state. That's one, and I want to know your thoughts on that. Number two, I had a former chemical engineer who was lecturing me, telling me, am I crazy? Because it's so volatile. Do I understand how explosive it is? And so I was hoping for comments on that as well.
Go ahead. Yes.
Yes, I would love to comment on those questions. I just lost the first question.
Representative Otto, you wish to restate?
Private industry.
Oh yes. Definitely so. The university should only be involved in basic research. That's the only thing we do well. We get into applied research or development demonstration plants, we do a bad job, and industry and the national labs and the Department of Energy should do that. We want to be involved in pre-competitive systems. We want to develop the new step-out technologies that aren't there yet. And this has not been done yet. This stuff that we did had not been demonstrated. You know, we couldn't find anything in the literature. We filed a patent on it, but we're not going to commercialize this. We don't want to do that. There's a huge effort in local industry and in state industries in this area. 3M has a big program in fuel cells. Integrys has a fair-sized program in fuel cells. Cargill is looking very hard at this. If the hydrogen economy comes into play, you got to know Cargill wants to be the player in this, and the university should not compete at all. But this is pre-competitive. We have to get started. We've got an entrenched petroleum industry that is, I will say, heavily subsidized, and we're not going to try to kill the petroleum industry, but this is a better way to do it, we think. We don't know how. And it's technology, economics, politics, and political will to make this happen. So I think those are the key. The second question, I lost that one too. Now, ethanol is less volatile and explosive than gasoline, and you fill your tank every week there. It's also non-toxic, unless you drink too much. You see, it's and we know it's non-toxic. We've been testing it out for a long time, and so things like methanol are methanol is an alternative, which is a fossil-based fuel. That's pretty toxic, and it's being banned. Ethanol is the fuel of choice. You make Cherry's Jubilee, right? You can burn it. It better burn because you want to do that. But it's less volatile than gasoline and much safer, both from flammability point of view as well as toxicity.
It's Representative Otto, are you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Now I'm losing my train of thought. Oh, yes, I know what it was. Now, I don't, and maybe this is a freshman question again, but is there any way as a state that we can allow some of these private large corporations who are very interested in ethanol and the hydrogen fuel cell technology, can we allow them to put some money in? Now that, I don't, that's a, I guess.
Is there further questions?
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. As you might guess, the Minnesota Corn Growers Association has contacted me and all of in the renewable energy initiative considerably. They're very much interested in this. My model, just a personal model of how this would go, is through these farm co-ops. I mean, which I don't know a great deal about, but the counties, the districts have these ethanol plants, and there's biodiesel plants being built. This is a great platform to begin to expand and move up the value chain in making bioproducts. So we already have a set of folks that are itching to get investment capital and improve. All we're looking for is pre-competitive funding just to get things moving and make sure that we've got the technology base to make this work.
Is there further questions? Representative Dennis.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say, first of all, briefly that, and take this as a compliment, I didn't think this was going to be very exciting, and your passion and your excitement for it is infective, and so thank you for that. We're all awake. My question is, if we compare the 20% with fuels, normal fuels, or the traditional, and the 80% efficiency with the ethanol, it is at the ethanol level. Does that difference in efficiency carry through to the hydrogen all the way across? Is that clear what I'm asking?
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Smith.
Yes. One of the issue you are raising, and it's the big one, and I'm a chemical engineer, so this is my deal, efficiency. All right? You have to make this without burning up a lot of energy, et cetera. And so ethanol production is getting much more efficient. These new plants that are coming on stream are much better than the ones 5 to 10 years ago. They're bigger. They just use much less energy. And this is the same idea. Efficiency. Right now, petroleum is, gasoline is, it's less than, it's more than half the price of ethanol. So gasoline prices will come up, ethanol prices will go down. And what we're talking about is not just burning the ethanol, and that's the main issue in hydrogen, but making electricity. And the electricity is a very inefficient process. It's only about 30% efficient in all the power plants, and you just can't beat that. That's thermodynamics. And so a fuel cell could beat that by a factor of 2. It beats it by a factor of 3 over just putting it in your gas tank and burning it.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, Mr. Representative Jogi, you wish to renew your motion.
Mr. Chair, I do, and I just want to close by saying, members, when people ask what it's like to be in the legislature, I often comment to them that it's like being in the best university in the land, because we get to sit and see the best and the brightest people come before us and discuss issues, and I think that's certainly the case with Dr. Lanny Schmidt today. And I'm certain that I'm going to get the support I need to move this along and at least keep the idea moving, because this is exciting stuff for us in rural Minnesota. And thank you for your support and your time today.
Thank you. And Representative Junkie renewed his motion that this be recommended to pass and referred to the Agriculture Finance Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Davids.
Yes, Ag Finance, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Representative David, welcome to the committee, and this is a bill dealing with ethanol producer payments, and I know that there's, would you, Representative Davids, we have a DE1 amendment. Would you like to take that or put that on? Or
Mr. Chairman, to get the bill in the shape that we want to talk about, and I'd like to go with the DE1 amendment and then the A2 amendment.
First of all, we'll take the DE1 amendment. All in favor of the DE1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That's carried. And then you said you have a...
A2 amendment, H176682, Mr. Chairman.
And the A2 amendment would be amended to the DE1, so...
To the bill.
All in favor of the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? There, then, Representative Davids, you have the bill in the manner that we are going to discuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, House File 1766 was a result of visiting with some of the members of the Board of Directors of the Pro Corn Ethanol Plant in Preston, Minnesota, and they were somewhat concerned about some of the reporting requirements that were put in the law last year. And what I'd like to do is inform the committee that the Department of Ag and the ethanol industry had some differences in House File 1766. The amendments have taken care of that. And what I'd like to do is have Mr. Jerry Seck make a few comments, and then the gentleman from the Department of Ag make a very few comments. I'm not aware of any opposition to this bill at this point. I think all the differences have been worked out. So we'll give you the Reader's Digest version by Mr. Jerry Seck here for the industry.
Okay, Mr. Seck, welcome to the committee, and to state your name for the record.
My name is Jerry Seck, and I represent the Minnesota Coalition for Ethanol, which includes 10 or 11 of the plants in Minnesota. The language that was included in the bill that was passed last year with the financial disclosure has caused an awful lot of heartburn and hard feelings among all the plants. They didn't like the language and didn't like it when it was starting to affect the producer payments. And basically they said a deal is a deal, and when we started building these plants, we didn't have to do this, and we're afraid that this will be a slippery slope. And once we start, if you see some plants are successful, you want to take producer payments away. And if you see they're unsuccessful, you say, well, gee, why do we put good money after bad? So there's a whole wide range of things. So when Representative Davids introduced his bill, all the plants were very supportive of that. We have had some discussions over the last 2 days with lots of folks, some folks on this committee, as well as the Department of Agriculture, and I think we've worked out the majority of our differences. There is one little language item that I mentioned to Paul Strandberg from Department of Agriculture that we're concerned with. But in general, we're in general supportive of this because it decouples the disclosure requirements from receiving producer payments and no longer is requiring us to submit the names and addresses of all of our members, many of whom want their privacy respected and so forth. So I think all the changes they've made, we've been very pleased with the changes that the Department of Agriculture has been willing to go along with. So in general, we're supportive.
Thank you. And Mrs. Strandberg, you have some remarks?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Paul Strandberg with the Department of Agriculture, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. As Mr. Seck indicated, we did have some problems with the entire repeal of the languages was contained in the original bill. And as he noted, over the last 2 days, we have arrived at something that we think balances privacy interests along with providing good information for decision makers, and we have agreed with the languages. It is now in front of the committee.
Thank you. Representative David, did you have other people wish to testify? We have several bills, but
we're trying to talk them out of it right now. We'll see how it went.
They're from Albert Lea, and they're generally agreeable to things as long as it goes their way, and they're generally thinking this is going their way. I can't speak for them, so.
Yeah. Well, no, they came up from Albert Lea, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. They want to make
if they, if they wish to make brief comments, here.
I don't feel it's necessary.
Well, thank you, and thank you for coming. But we'd give you the opportunity for brief remarks, but if
and Mr. Chairman, if there's questions from committee members, yeah. we certainly welcome them to the table.
So is there questions from committee members on this bill? Like Representative, like Mr. Sex said, there's been a lot of discussions going on the last couple of days to try and reach a consensus. So, but is there questions, anybody? If not,
Mr. Chairman,
Representative David, do you have more? Do you have more to say?
Yeah, Mr. Sex. If you look at what the A2 amendment that's now part of the bill, both sides have also agreed on line 21, delete the words in the middle of the sentence of each plan. So it reads, disclosure statements will be contained in the report to the committee chairs and will be public data.
Would you repeat that?
Okay, so on line 21 of what was the A2 amendment, we would delete of each plan. And both sides have signed off on that.
Well, I'll move that amendment, oral amendment. Any discussion? If not, all in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion carried. So then, Representative Davids, the bill is in the manner you'd like to move it forward?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm.
Well, then I'll renew the motion that House File 1766 be recommended to pass and forwarded to the Agriculture Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. And Representative Davids has another bill that he's author of also. I think as long as he's here, I know he's got his own committee going in another room, but so we'll try and accommodate him as long as he's in the room. And this is House File 2750, dealing with the biodiesel mandate subject. And Representative Davids, I would move that this bill also be recommended to pass and forwarded to the Agriculture Finance Committee. So, Representative Davids, you wish to explain the bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. If we could get the bill in the shape that we need to talk about it, if there's an A1 amendment.
Okay, the A1 amendment, I will move the A1 amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Proceed with your testimony or explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'd like to introduce Bruce Hine with Magellan. It's Magellan Midstream Partners, which runs some pipeline that serves the state of Minnesota and the Midwest and actually other parts of the country also. And I would like to turn it over to him to describe the bill as to what we're trying to do here. And then I don't know if there's opposition or people who would like to testify that have concerns about the bill or not here.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Hine. I'm with Magellan Midstream Partners. We own and operate what was known to many of you as the Williams Pipeline Company. We have five petroleum distribution terminals here in the state of Minnesota. And the Williams Pipeline, now the Magellan Pipeline System, is roughly 6,700 miles of refined products pipes running through 11 Midwestern states. Here in Minnesota, we supply or provide distribution services for approximately 50% of the diesel fuel distributed into the state. So we are a significant participant and stakeholder as it relates to biodiesel. But we are as ethanol as well. We don't own the products in our system. Those customers of ours own those products, refiners, importers, and others. But we distribute those products to market for them. In other words, from our petroleum terminals, which receives the product inbound by pipeline, we have distribution racks where the trucks load 8,000 gallons or so of petroleum products and take those out to the retail markets. So that's the service that we provide to our stakeholders in Minnesota. I mentioned ethanol. We're one of the larger distributors of ethanol through our system in the United States. 27 of our 40 terminals on the Magellan Pipeline System distribute ethanol, and some have as long ago as the 1980s, the early 1980s. So we're no stranger to renewables. We've also been working with the Congress as it relates to the volumetric ethanol tax credits, which include the biodiesel tax credits, trying to improve the workability of those types of tax credits if indeed Congress ever does take action to pass those into law. We support House File 2750. What it effectively would do if this bill were to become law would to have biodiesel blended at the terminal instead of downstream at bulk plants. In other words, let me explain that. Biodiesel today could be blended where the diesel fuel is loaded at a petroleum terminal such as ours, and could the truck would then go downstream to a bulk plant and load the biodiesel on top of the diesel fuel. What this bill would do would be to move that blending upstream inside the terminal gate. And that's important for a number of reasons. From a technical side, it helps to reduce the potential of biodiesel forming crystals during the cold weather months, and that is a legitimate technical problem associated with the biodiesel program in Minnesota. It helps to minimize that. It doesn't completely eliminate it. We're still doing testing to that regard, but it moves it in the right direction. It also helps to provide a product that is not stratified. In other words, the biodiesel it has a heavier gravity, or it's heavier in weight than diesel fuel itself. If it's added outside of our petroleum terminal, the weight of the product will allow the biodiesel to go to the bottom, and therefore you may have a B2 or a biodiesel concentration of 7 or 8% at the bottom of the tank, a B1 in the middle of the tank, and B0 at the top of the tank. And so that's going to be very difficult for the Department of Commerce to enforce. So those are some of the technical reasons. From a policy standpoint, moving biodiesel blending up to the terminal is consistent with a national trend to help minimize tax fraud if indeed the biodiesel industry is successful in getting their tax credits at some point in time on the federal basis. So this approach doesn't necessarily resolve all of the issues associated with the biodiesel program, nor does it eliminate all of the challenges that stakeholders such as us will be dealing with, but it is certainly a move in the right direction. And we think that it provides a level playing field for those that are in the same business that we are. We think that it's good for the biodiesel industry itself by moving their product into the mainstream of petroleum distribution. And that's very important for the long-term growth of the biodiesel industry compared to where it is today. So in closing, I would encourage the committee to pass the bill out today in its amended format, as Representative Davis has suggested. And we've worked with other stakeholders in the process, including the soybean growers, to address some of their concerns to allow the continuation of B10 and B20 blends into the marketplace. Thank you very much.
Mr. Hine, who do you feel will be the beneficiary of this legislation if it passes? I mean, is it going to be a beneficiary to the pipeline people, the people that own and operate the pipelines, or is it a beneficiary to the consumer, or what really prompted you to bring this forth?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a benefit to a number of different stakeholders in the process, including the consumer. From the consumer standpoint, inline blending systems, which is a type of a system that terminals have in some cases for ethanol today, in other cases for additive type systems. We are looking at this type of a system for biodiesel to ensure that the quality of the blend is there. So as I mentioned earlier, from a bulk plant type blending operation, the consumer would think that they're purchasing B2 at the pump when indeed it's something different than that. So this bill would help assure that the product out at the retail service station or the truck stop was indeed a B2 blend. It also helps to reduce the level of risk associated with biodiesel infrastructure. And there is a level of risk associated with making those investments from a couple of different standpoints. This bill helps to reduce that risk, and from our company's standpoint, would help us move closer to putting biodiesel infrastructure in, which is not there today, and is very different than the playing field that we dealt with ethanol a few years ago, where the infrastructure to distribute the ethanol was there to a great extent prior to the Minnesota ethanol mandate. And that is not the case at all with biodiesel. So the infrastructure needs to be built, and this would help move us along to help do that.
Thank you. And I have a couple other members have questions, but I would like to ask Jerry Schoenfeld, who with the Soybean Growers Association, if he has comments or opinion on this issue.
And Mr. Chairman,
yes.
And members, while Mr. Schoenfeld's coming down, my whole purpose, you know, I've been a big supporter of biodiesel over the years, as many members of this committee have been, probably all the members of this committee. And this bill, I think, would help make it work. And I just want to make it work so that they get the good blend, so that it's in right at the terminal, so it's part of the terminal, so we can't, you know, make it easy to, yeah, to get rid of it. I'm also very interested to hear what this, you know, this is all about the soybean producers, yes, and we want to make sure it works for them too. So that's why we're here.
Yes, and Representative Davids, Mr. Hein mentioned the soybean growers, and Mr. Schoenfeld works with them. So I would just like to know if he has any comments or perspective on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to say, Mr. Chairman, that you had requested that I come down here. Yeah. Originally, the soybean growers were not going to testify on this bill. They have a neutral position on this bill, but I think probably as yourselves, there's a lot of questions that a lot of people are asking about it. One of the things I would tell you is that there is a biodiesel task force that was organized by the governor, which tomorrow, I believe, is going to be meeting and discussing some of these kinds of issues. I think that in the crowd, you'd probably recognize that there are representatives from many parts of the oil industry, and I don't think any of them intend to testify in the bill either. And I guess what that really leaves us with is a lot of people that are looking at it, aren't quite certain, and maybe have some questions, but are not sure that it's a good thing or a bad thing. So because of that, Mr. Chairman, we do take a neutral position. I don't think it would be our intent to stop the bill at this point, but at the same time, we'd like to have some more thought about it. The bill came in a week ago, and perhaps there can be some ways to perhaps work with that situation where people would want to continue to think about this. I would point out that it is true that, as Mr. Hines had pointed out, that there was a provision in the bill that did concern the soybean growers, and that was the fact that it required the 2% blend that's required under the state mandate would all be done at the terminal. The concern there was that there were other places in the state that are operating right now. I believe there's, I probably could get some help from my colleagues up here, but I think there's somewhat over 100 stations in the state that offer some 200 that offer some biodiesel at the present time. Most of those would be in bulk blending kinds of situations, not supplied through a terminal. We would agree that the terminal is probably the preferred choice, that is where this thing needs to go. But there are probably also some places, and I'm not an expert on distribution, but in discussions with a variety of people over the last several years on this, there are probably some places in the state that may not be supplied by a terminal, because the terminals that supply them come from outside of the state, or that there may be some areas that wouldn't, or where there might be some other type of blending that would be necessary. So there was the amendment, the A1 amendment, does deal with some of that in the fact that it allows for upblending beyond the B2. For instance, the Kennebec County at the present time has got an agreement with a number of metropolitan government area around here. I think Washington County may be in that, some others, in which they, I think, run a B5 at the present time. And that is blended by a, I believe it's blended by a private company called LubeTech. And they are presently batch blending that. This bill would affect them potentially, I suppose, in the fact that it would be a different point of competition in that, but I'm not certain, and I suspect that they're here, and I don't really know that would be a good or a bad thing. I guess is what I'm saying is there's a lot of things that we don't really, are not quite certain, because there's a lot of questions, I guess, that the industry that does the blending and so forth needs to answer. And so I'm not giving you much help or much of an answer, except that I would say that I think it's something that people do believe in general, that the terminals are the places it's going to have to go to in general, but it would have some caveats to that, that there are some other involvements here probably that aren't always served by the terminals. And so I guess, Mr. Chairman, that's about as much as I can say, and with that, I hope I maintain my neutrality at that point.
Thank you. Representative David.
Well, Mr. Chairman, at this point, it sounds like the soybean growers are enthusiastically neutral. But what I'd like to make very clear to this committee and to Mr. Schoenfeld and the soybean growers is that as this moves along, it hasn't been here that long, if this moves along and there's some problems that they see, please come to me immediately because we want to make this work for everybody. We want it to be a main street or a mainstream fuel. I think that's good for the industry. It, in my mind, it locks it in. But if there's some things that the soybean growers need, we're certainly all ears and want to work with you on that.
Thank you. And I have a couple other members that have questions. Representative Demmer, I think you were next. Did you have a question of whoever?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question is very closely related to Mr. Schoenfeld's discussion. Basically, I have three questions. How many terminals are there in the state of Minnesota that would be doing this blending? Will this assure availability to all sections of the state in terms of biodiesel having it available? My understanding, and it's, I don't know if it's a clear understanding, is that, for example, some of the more further away places have difficulty transporting the biodiesel, especially in the wintertime, or at least the bio part of it, the oil during the wintertime, and so maybe this would take care of that. But will this assure availability to every place in the state? And I think you kind of addressed that, Mr. Schoenfeld. And also, how will this affect the cost of biodiesel at the pump?
Mr. Heine, you wish to try and answer this question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to. I believe there are 13 terminals that would be affected. In regards to assuring supply outside the state, I'd like to go back first to Representative. Well, let me address it both ways because I think they're connected. It is indeed true that a lot of diesel fuel that is consumed in Minnesota comes from terminals outside the state. In fact, some of those terminals are owned by Magellan and distribute large quantities of diesel, such as Fargo and Mason City or Clear Lake, Iowa, into the state. We are looking at biodiesel facilities at those terminals as well, and we'll make our decision based on economics and what our customers ask us to do. That's how we built these ethanol blending systems that I referred to earlier, that 27 out of our 40 terminals on the pipeline have ethanol blending capabilities. And some of those systems cost upwards to $1 million a piece to install. So as it relates to biodiesel outside of the state, we'll look at that on a case-by-case basis and make determinations in working with our customers. If that's what they're looking for us to do and the economics are there, then that's what we'll provide for them. That's not a universal application, and don't take it like that, that every terminal outside the state that's supplying biodiesel in the state is not assured nor affected by this legislation. It does affect the terminals in the state. They have two choices. Either they would install biodiesel blending systems or they would stop distributing diesel that's affected by this legislation. So I hope that addressed that segment of your question. The third question in regards to cost, again, under the existing legislation, the existing legislation requires biodiesel at retail. All of the service station dealers and truck stop operators across the state have to determine how they're going to get 2% biodiesel in their diesel fuel, or else they can't sell diesel for on-road applications or for internal combustion engines. There's nothing in the existing bill that requires us to install biodiesel at our terminals. And in that case, we're looking at losing 2% of our volume, not the entire 100%, as if indeed this bill were to pass. So as it relates to cost, there's two factors and maybe more that you need to consider. One is the cost of the biodiesel itself in relation to diesel fuel. And what's that going to cost the consumer just based on the raw cost alone, the cost differentials alone? Without federal tax credits, that cost is rather substantial. If indeed the volumetric ethanol tax credits pass in one of the international tax bills or the highway bill or an energy bill, if that ever comes through someday in the Congress, then that diminishes substantially the differential on product cost. The second is distribution cost. What it's going to cost to distribute through the terminal system, the trucking cost to get it from a biodiesel plant to the terminal itself, in the markup fee that will that a marketer or a biodiesel producer will add on onto that to sell their commodities in the current marketplace. So there are a couple of different pieces to it. It's not best for Magellan Midstream Partners to answer a specific question on cost, but there will be a distribution cost, there will be a product differential cost, and there will be other factors that the marketplace will bear out. But we indeed do think that there will be an impact to the consumer, and one that has been debated in many committees during the original biodiesel requirement back a few years ago.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. I guess my question on the availability was related more to stations or retailers throughout the state of Minnesota. Would this help in their ability to acquire biodiesel was more my question. Does blending at the terminal make it more available to stations throughout the state that are required to carry biodiesel? That was a question. Maybe it won't affect it. I don't know, but that was my question. And the other thing relating to the cost, I realize that biodiesel has a cost compared to standard diesel. My question really was, will this make any difference in the cost of diesel, biodiesel availability compared to how we're doing it now?
And Mr. Heine, and if we could get as brief a answer as possible, because we're looking at the clock. But
yes, sir.
Do you have any more?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. In regards to the product availability, as the law states today, the retailer has a similar choice to the terminal. Either they have 2% biodiesel or they don't sell diesel. I would believe that having the availability at the terminal is advantageous for the distributor, because it eliminates the potential that they would go downstream and blend or receive their diesel at one terminal and then go to some other bulk plant to blend it to biodiesel. So I can't speak for the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers, but I would believe that that would be something that would appeal to them, predominantly for the jobbers that are serviced by terminals in the middle of the state. As it relates to your question on overall cost, I would just defer to what I had mentioned earlier, Representative.
Representative Peterson, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Davids and Mr. Hines. On page 2, lines 4 and 5, you're referring to in your last comments about the downstream or upstream. The number, lines 4, diesel fuel must not be blended with additional biodiesel after it is transferred or otherwise removed from the terminal.
Yeah. Mr. Peterson, the 81 amendment removed that.
The whole thing?
Lines 4 and
lines
5.
Lines 4 and 5.
Oh, okay, well, thank you. I just did the other two. So, okay, thank you, Chairman. I do have a couple follow-ups, though, I guess, on that. Given that you testified that you have 50% of the state's diesel that's sold, and that if this is done only at the terminal, does this make yourself a de facto distributor and minimize competition in the state of Minnesota for biodiesel? And I wonder about how much time and energy has been spent in this effort in the district I represent, that there seems to be a lot of local buy-in and a lot of support for biodiesel in small batches, and people do blend at above 2%. And I know that part got taken out, and I've been educated here on lines 4 and 5. But what kind of barrier to entry do you provide, maybe not intentionally, but unintentionally, with this change and this preferred method of distribution upstream versus downstream at my local co-ops all throughout Minnesota? And I'm just wondering, I've got about that, and I don't really see it being talked too much about. I would recommend that the committee take a hard look at this bill and not just let it sail through. And listen to what Mr. Schoenfeld said, and even come back next year or the year after, and so we don't dig ourselves a hole and sell out a homegrown industry to a company that doesn't even really have a lot of investment nor own what we're trying to produce here.
May I respond?
That was more of a statement probably than a question, but
Mr. Chairman, yes, I do think it requires a strong statement, though, yeah. Because I hope you know what you're doing here.
I'm not.
That's my question. I hope you know what you're doing.
I'm not disputing
because
your question.
Because because I just feel like this is quick and dirty, and quick and dirty doesn't work for me on biodiesel.
Representative Johnson, do you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess to the author or anyone else, as Cooper used to always ask, why? And in testimony, you stated that you want it blended at the terminal rather than in line because in line blending tends to crystallize more readily than at the terminal. If that's the case, it would seem to me that if, as a distributor of the product and as customers that buy it, you'd want the best product and you'd be doing that anyway. Why would it be blended in line if it's got crystallization problems? Why do we even need this, is my question. So wouldn't you be doing the best practices anyway? Who's going to blend it in line where it's going to crystallize more? Why would we have to require that? I'm not following at all the logic for this.
Okay, sir.
Mr. Heine or Representative David.
I may not have been very clear when I briefly mentioned the inline blending. What I mean by inline blending is a sophisticated computerized blending system that blends in the biodiesel into the diesel at the respective proportion. In other words, the diesel will be going into the truck at the same time the biodiesel will. That type of a high-tech blending system minimizes the potential for crystallization during the cold weather months. Today, the practices in place would be that a driver will load 8,000 gallons or 7,500 gallons of diesel at our terminal, go across the street to a bulk plant, and splash blend the biodiesel in. That type of a splash blending or downstream operation is where the crystallization can become a significant or more of a significant problem.
But again, Mr. Chair, why would someone do that if it's a problem? Why would they do that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the law today requires that the retailer have 2% biodiesel in their tanks at their station. There is nothing to require a terminal operator to make that investment. If the economics are not there to spend anywhere from $750 million upwards for a biodiesel blending system, then the justification is not there to install that. Again, the volume at risk, representative, is 2%. So it is indeed an economic decision for terminal operators like us. We'll listen clearly to our customers if they want us to put it in. This bill advances past that and effectively assures that you'll have these types of systems in the terminals for the biodiesel industry in the long term. And again, I encourage the members to look at this from the long term perspective. There are virtually no biodiesel terminals at petroleum terminals today. They're downstream of that. 97% of all ethanol is blended at terminals today, according to the Renewable Fuels Association. And we're a big part of that.
And Mr. Chair, just to follow up quickly, I don't have a problem with the bill. And to represent Peterson's point, terminals very clearly described. We're only talking about one certain type of facility, and this bill has nothing to do with our homegrown blenders or anything else because of the definition of terminals. So that's not my concern. The concern I have is, again, number one, why do we really need it? And I'll talk to people, Mr. Chair, beyond this committee to get that answered, along with Mr. Schoenfeld. But the second question is to Representative Davids and others, and to members of this committee, I just get nervous. If a bill like this gets to the floor and opens up that section of law to amendment, that's where I get nervous when any of these come through. And that's why I'm questioning if we really need this, because, you know, we don't want any firefights down the line on the floor of the House like we saw a few years ago with this bill, and it makes a lot of stuff germane.
Representative Davids, I'm ready to make a statement, but you, okay. If you go ahead first.
If I could, first of all, to Representative Peterson's comments, I think Representative Junkie explained where I think some of those may be somewhat unfounded. But I would also make this commitment to the members here. If there's problems with the soybeans growers on this, if this gets to the House floor and becomes a Christmas tree for a lot of things we don't like, that bill will be pulled so fast you don't even know what happened. Be out getting a cup of water and the thing's gone. And that's a commitment that I have, because if there's, I am not here in any way, I mean, I'm a big supporter of biodiesel, as I said, with most members of this committee. And if we're going to play Christmas tree with this, with some folks that are against biodiesel, this bill's history. it is history, and I'll pull it. I'll need some support if they try and go after and say, well, you don't have control of the bill anymore, you know, some of those types of things. But generally, the House has been very good on not playing those games as far as the bill being able, that often being able to control his own, his or her own bill. So that's a concern I have, too, and I'm not going there.
Members, we have a couple other bills today that we wanted to get to. I think after the discussion, what I'm going to do is change my motion and that we pass this bill on to the Finance Committee without recommendation, and if it's heard over there, you can have some discussions between now and then, and probably an opportunity for further questions at that time. So with that, I'm going to renew the motion that this bill be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance without recommendation.
As amended.
As amended. As amended. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
So you can have further discussion with people in the meantime. So, thank you.
Representative Blaine, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Blaine, House File 2894, which I think is a department bill, but so you want to proceed?
Thank you, Chairman Swenson, for the tape. I'm Representative Greg Blaine, District 12B. Mr. Chair and members, House File 2894 that's in front of us today is a bill that I'm actually pretty excited about. I think this is a bill that addresses a lot of issues and values that I hold as a representative and certainly a representative of rural Minnesota, but also in an area that always concerns me, and that's being efficient and effective as a governing body.
Representative Blaine, did you move the bill?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd move that House File 2894 be recommended to pass and be referred. I'm pretty sure we're going to have to go over to Chairwoman Harder's Agriculture Finance Committee.
Yeah, proceed then.
Members, House File 2894 is a bill, it is a department bill that addresses a couple of and very important issues that we've been talking a lot about this session and sessions past, and one of those issues is what can we do and what will we do to help the dairy farmers in the state of Minnesota. And one of the big issues that we've heard from dairy farmers, from Minnesota Milk Producers Association, and from others within the industry, is that farmers have asked for a better access to capital for improvements and enhancements on their dairy operations. Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, I'd like to walk through the bill, and I will do this very quickly. Everyone, I'm sure, has a copy of the bill, and I know that there is an amendment, but I'd like to take that after we've gone through the bill, and as I said, I'll do this very quickly, members. Section 1 of the bill establishes a revolving loan account, and this would be established to implement a dairy upgrade pilot loan program for financing of the purchase of breeding stock, feedlot, and other environmental regulations and concerns, and also the purchase of equipment and facilities improvements. Subdivision 2 of Section 1 deals with the eligibility of this program, which is pretty self-explanatory. subdivision 3 deals with the participation limits of this loan program. If you notice on page 2, lines 5, 6, and 7, participation is limited to 45% of the principal amount of the loan, or $50,000, whichever is less. Line 13 of page 2 is important. The interest rate on this must not exceed 4%. If we skip down to section 2, it talks about these loans and the securities of these loans. Section 3 deals with the repayment of the monies to this revolving loan account. Section 4 deals with the authority of this account, which would be handled through the RFA. It spells out that this is a revolving loan account. Section 5 and Section 5 deals with where this money is coming from. And this is part of what I like about this bill. It's a forward, in my estimation, a forward proactive step by the Department of Ag and will be also by us at the legislature with the efficiency of the utilization of funds that we now have available. These funds are would come from the methane digester fund account and the value-added product loan program. The amount of monies that are in these two programs are not always fully utilized at one time. So we have money sitting in these accounts that is waiting for utilization. By what we're going to do with this bill is create one loan account that will cover the methane digester account, the value-added product loan program, and then also this initiative to have capital access for the dairy farmers. Would roll this into one revolving loan account, thus utilizing monies that we already have, so we're not having to go out and try and find an extra pot of money or have bonding money or any other money out there. It's an efficiency, and I commend the Department of Ag for seeing this and in bringing this forward. It's just a better utilization of money that we already have, and this is a forward attempt to make this more accessible to the dairy producers out there. It also keeps this money addressed to serve agriculture. It kind of puts this money in more of a safekeeping so that bureaucracy, in my estimation, would not be tempted to look at trying to capture some of this money that may not always be utilized at one point in time and using it for other measures. This bill is size neutral. This does not favor large dairy farmers over small dairy farmers or small over large. At this point in time, I guess I'd like to, Mr. Chair, if it's all right, I'd like to ask Wayne Marzoff from the RFA to help clean up things that I have missed, and then we would be willing to stand for questions before we take the amendment.
Would you, thank you, Representative Blaine, and Mr. Marzoff, would you want to talk to this bill before we do the amendment, or... I know we have an amendment that Mr. Marzoff is going to explain also, but whichever way you wish to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Wayne Marzoff, the Interim Director of the Ag Finance Division of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Within the Ag Finance Division, the Rural Finance Authority is one of the primary activities. Just to let the committee know, this is an initiative that comes from the department. Has the approval of the governor's office. And Mr. Chair, I think we'll go ahead and take the amendment, and then we'll go with the bill.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I'm going to offer the A1 amendment to this bill, and Representative Blaine is aware of it. Basically, I think if you all look through it, there's underlined language on page 3, and I would move this amendment, and if we want to vote on it, or do we want Mr. Marzoff to? I guess I would move the amendment. If there are any questions on the amendment, otherwise, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's carried. And Mr. Marzoff, would you wish to comment on the amendment and the bill as quickly as possible, I guess?
I will try, Mr. Chair, very briefly as far as the amendment is concerned. The Rural Finance Authority under Statute 41B has a fairly significant number of authorities to perform various types of duties, fiduciary responsibilities of the board, which is a board of 11 people. 5 of those are represented from state agencies. 6 are public members. This just provides us with additional flexibility to work with other agencies to gather resources that may be directed towards specific agricultural purposes. To the bill as a total, this continues utilizing the system that we have developed over a number of years that has become very efficient in the utilization of about 420 banking service centers to deliver these loans. They initiate the loan, they service the loan. We buy 45% of that loan at a lower interest rate and provide some benefit to eligible dairy farmers. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would just stand for a question.
Is there questions from members on the bill as amended? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, how does this affect the methane digester program?
Mr. Marzoff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, basically what we're doing here is that there's a pot designated specifically for, at the present time, of the methane digester loan program. There's also another pot that's specified distinctly for the value-added stock loan program, as we call it. Right now, there's a substantial cash in both of those accounts that, in due fact, if we pool this into one account with the 3 different programs accessing the one account, we can more efficiently utilize those resources and respond to whatever farmers are in need of at a particular time. The board is committed to reserving some of those funds for methane digesters specifically, so if we get an application, that will certainly, and the interest rate on the methane digester loan program is different than this program here, so the board would, and we as the staff would work with those different interest rates.
Any other questions? If not, Representative Blaine, you wish to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I wish to move House File 2894 and have it sent to the Committee on Agriculture Finance.
As amended.
As amended.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It's carried. We have Representative Hornstein. Is he here? I think he said, when we're waiting for Representative Hornstein, I think we had one bill that we heard earlier, and we made, at that time, we laid it aside for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. I don't think at this time it looks like we would probably have anything to put with it as an omnibus bill, so I would like to, I don't think we need discussion. This bill has been discussed previously, but I would like to change the motion that House File 2461 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Correct.
Is there any discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Oh,
excuse me.
They're just getting it over. Okay, you want to wait a second.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Duncan.
I did have a discussion with Secretary of State's office on this, and they were reviewing it and thought they did have some tune-up for it, and I guess my concern is if it goes general register, will Cornish be able, will you have to do that on the floor, or is this something we should send to a finance committee if in case there's a tune-up needed, and obviously he's not here right now to ask, but well, I did talk to Bert Black in the Secretary of State's office 2 days ago. He said he had looked at the bill and he had made some suggestions for it. To Cornish, so I don't know if you've talked to Cornish about it or
Representative
not.
Cornish has not talked to me. Could we make a motion to the floor, and if it need to be have to be re-referred then to a finance committee, I suppose. Would that be agreeable? And it could always, I suppose it could always be amended on the floor too if it had to be, but so I think that's what I'd like to do. So, here's Representative Cornish. Representative Cornish, House File 2461, which you were the chief author, we laid aside when we heard the bill, and it doesn't appear that we're going to have an omnibus bill, so I would trying to refer this to the floor, or do you feel it needs to go someplace else?
No, that would be... appreciate if it would go to the floor. There's no opposition that I know of.
Representative Junkie.
Just to represent Cornish, a friendly comment. I talked to Bert Black the other day. I think he was looking at your bill and was going to send you some recommendations on it. Again, we talked about the uniformity of it, if you remember, and some of those things. So I just want you to be prepared. There may be some minor amending language that may be needed. That's why we're asking if you want to go to the floor and do that, or go down like the Harder's Finance Committee and do it before it goes to the floor, if it's needed.
Yeah,
I'd actually rather have it do the floor and do a floor amendment. And he's the guy that's testified on this is open to amending it.
All right, if that's your wish, well then we will make the motion, or you can make the motion to send it to the floor then. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passed. I know it's Representative Hornstein. Has he come back?
Where's he at?
I think he said room 200.
Yes.
I thought somebody probably did go, but Representative Hornstein has House File 2864 before us. And does he, did witnesses present that we have listed at Mr. Steve Silverfarb? And also Professor David Colbin. If they're there, here, they could probably come up to the podium if you want to come up to the table. And then if Representative Hornstein comes, we'll be ready to go because we're going to be running short of time soon. But Representative Hagerken?
Yeah, I'll move that House File 2864 be included in our omnibus bill or be general register.
The general register.
Okay.
Yeah. General. In the interest of time, would one of you wish to explain the bill or so we can? This will soon be running out of time. But
yeah,
so, and
Chairman,
state your name for the record, and Representative Hagerken did move the bill, so it's before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity today to testify regarding House File 2864, a measure to repair the existing Minnesota law on kosher foods and make it constitutional, effective, and enforceable. And, Mr. Chairman, If you'll permit me to suspend, Representative Hornstein has arrived. I'd be happy to defer to him and continue my remarks after he makes the presentation.
Well, thank you. And Representative Hornstein, do you wish to make some opening remarks?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate everyone sticking around. I have a bill up in Transportation Committee, and I'm going to have to deal with that in a couple of minutes. So, members, just let me just start off by publicly thanking Representative Erdahl. Very early last session, he hosted Representative Ellison and I and gave us a tour of Litchfield, of the district cheese processing facility. We visited a dairy farm. And the reason I mention this, Mr. Speaker and members, is that there's a real spirit of reaching out to us in the urban community, and I appreciate it very much. And he has since come to the city and shared some family events with us, and it's very much appreciated, so thank you. I haven't really had a chance to publicly thank you for that. Mr. Chair and members, this bill is really quite simple. And as our testifiers have begun to talk to you about and will continue to talk about, is that this is really a question of some constitutional issues. Now, members, our community, like many of your faith communities and even your families, we have disagreements. You'll hear some of those today. But I want us to keep focused on why we're before you, why this is even in state law. And it's not for the legislature to choose one party or another in terms of this kosher process, and that's the crux of the issue. And so that's why we have a constitutional scholar here. That's why the Jewish Community Relations Council is here. You've started to hear some of the testimony. I'd like it to continue, but as a courtesy to members, if you have questions of the author, I will remain for those, but I want to just be very, very simple. This is very simple and very straightforward, and it is really a question of the United States Constitution, and that's why we're before you today.
And so thank you, Representative Hornstein, and your next witness, where to continue?
Okay, one last thing, Mr. Chair and members. I want to also welcome one of the opponents, Rabbi Goldberger, also a friend. And I want to make sure that he's called up to testify. I know that we had contacted people about that, and I want to let you know he will be also making some brief comments. So thank you again, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, and I'll go up to transportation and then come back.
And so we're going to, we'll probably have to try and get this finished in about 15 minutes at the most,
okay.
if it's possible.
Okay.
So just kind of keep that in mind.
I
don't know how many people you have to talk.
There is one additional witness, Rabbi Morris Allen, and I will just instruct everybody in my community here to please keep it brief because that's very important value at this time of the year here in the legislature.
Well,
thank you.
And whoever wishes to speak next, welcome and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the panel. My name is Steve Silberfarb. I'm Executive Director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas. The JCRC, as we're known, is the designated public affairs voice of the Jewish community. The existing Minnesota statute was enacted to afford kosher consumers protection against false or misleading labeling of food as kosher. It's a protection that Minnesotans have enjoyed for more than 40 years. A statute that achieves this objective and is constitutionally sound continues to be of great importance to the Jewish community. But recent rulings in the courts, including a Supreme Court decision, have overturned nearly identical statutes in other states, most notably New Jersey, New York, and Maryland. And in Illinois, the state legislature there wisely amended the Illinois statute before it could be struck down by the courts. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there is no dispute that the current law is legally unenforceable, and the minute anyone attempts to enforce it, the courts will strike it down. The bottom line is that our current statute is not doing what it was meant to do, and we have to fix it so that it is constitutional and effective. House File 2864 is a bipartisan bill that seeks to keep intact the best and most important language of the current statute while amending the obsolete language courts have deemed unconstitutional. It is a work in progress that will hopefully be improved as the legislative process advances. fixing the current statute is the best and, frankly, the only way to preserve the intent of the current statute, which is to provide anti-fraud and deceptive practices protection to consumers of kosher food. The Minnesota statute currently regards kosher food as that which has been, quote, prepared in accordance with the Orthodox Hebrew religious requirements, end quote. Even someone like me, hardly a constitutional scholar, can understand that the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution precludes the state from bestowing a facial preference by favoring one religious group over another. A similar statute naming reform or conservative streams of Judaism would be equally flawed. A statute that purported to grant the Catholic Church or the Lutheran Church the authority to determine Christian religious rituals would also be constitutional. I am not here to tell you which rabbi's judgment on kashrut issues is right or wrong. They're all my friends. They're my teachers. I respect and treasure each and every one of them. I am here to respectfully suggest that it is not the role of the state to decide kashrut issues either. The incontrovertible fact is that the current Minnesota statute would not hold up under court scrutiny. Therefore, we are proactively, as the Jewish community agency tasked with serving the interests of the entire Jewish community, seeking to change the Minnesota statute so that it both continues to afford important consumer protections and is not in violation of the Establishment Clause. In other states where this law has been struck down or proactively amended, Orthodox, conservative, and reform groups, the mainstreams of Judaism, have all recognized that a kosher statute is still needed, and they have worked together to make changes. There is no alternative but to repair this constitutionally flawed law. I am hopeful that as this process moves forward, representatives of the Orthodox, conservative, and reform movements in Minnesota will work together to agree on a measure to provide the necessary consumer protections within a constitutionally permissible framework. Today, with your support, we will take this necessary first step. We have provided for you, I think the clerk has handed out, a short background on this topic, both explaining kosher concepts and summarizing case law and remedies considered or adopted by other states. I think you also hopefully have this book, this very short book that I'm sure everybody has time to read, about the Jewish dietary laws. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for considering our views, and I'm pleased to answer any questions at the appropriate time.
Thank you, and I think we'll let whoever else is going to speak continue.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is David Coburn. I'm a professor of law at Hamline University School of Law, professor of constitutional law, and I've taught at Hamline for 27 years. I was asked to look at the constitutionality of the current Minnesota law that require foods labeled as kosher be prepared or processed in accordance with Orthodox Hebrew requirements. Those very same provisions were in the New York laws, they were challenged in New York and were found to be unconstitutional. The same words. The New York court, unanimous opinion of the Second Circuit, found it unconstitutional, and certiorari was denied by the Supreme Court. Very similar language was also found unconstitutional in New Jersey in 1992 in Ron Dobbs versus the state of New Jersey. The problem with setting Orthodox Jewish principles as the basis for determining kashrut is that it's selecting one strain of Judaism to be the expert for all. Both the Supreme Court of New Jersey and the Second Circuit of the United States found that those provisions violated the Establishment Clause by both advancing and inhibiting religion and excessively entangling the government with religion. And in the United States Supreme Court, in Larson versus Valenti, which involved the Minnesota law, said, and I quote, "The clearest command of the Establishment Clause is that one religious denomination cannot be officially preferred over another." When I consulted with my colleagues today about my testimony and asked their advice, there was unanimity. It is not a difficult constitutional question.
Thank you. And I don't know how many more people we have, or do we have somebody that has a different view on it, probably would like to? So, identify the record, and, you know, if you could have about 2 or 3 minutes each, it's probably all the time we have, but I welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm delighted to be here. My name is Rabbi Chaim Goldberger, and I am the director of the Twin Cities Kashrut Council, which is the representative of the consumers in the Twin Cities and throughout the state of Minnesota in the certification and supervision of kosher food in the state. I'm here to oppose this bill and the changes it would make to the state kosher law. And I want to begin by just educating you a little bit about kosher. I had a small item of coffee over there that I had asked to have sent around. And if you take a look at the front of it, you'll notice in the lower left-hand corner a small symbol. And this is a symbol that you will find on many items in the grocery store. If you take a look for it, it's a U with a circle around it. Now, that is commonly known as the OU. O stands for Orthodox, and U stands for Union. The Orthodox Union is the largest certifier of kosher products throughout the world. It is that symbol that the kosher consumer, or similar symbols, that the kosher consumer looks for when they go into the supermarket and they want to know that they're buying something which is genuinely kosher. What we do here in our council is we make sure that the Orthodox standard, which is the gold standard in kosher, is maintained, is upheld, and is guaranteed when someone comes into a store in Minnesota and wants to buy something kosher. The supporters of this bill would have you believe that there's just the removal of some archaic language that's involved, and that it's a constitutional issue. I beg to differ. I'm not archaic. I am the Orthodox Hebrew that it's referring to. And we have spent the last 50 years in partnership with the state in providing standards that everybody could rely on, Orthodox and non-Orthodox alike. First of all, there is nothing in the Constitution that prevents the state from protecting the consumer from confusion and from misrepresentation. If anything, that is the job of this committee. Changing the state statute would provide as much protection to the consumer who recognizes kosher as being in adherence with Orthodox kosher standards, about as much protection as an umbrella with a hole in it would provide protection. The other point I'd like to make about that is if there is a constitutional issue, this bill is not going to help. Because if the government is too involved in religion, there should not be a kosher law at all. Amending the kosher law to take away the standard that's been maintained and practiced for the benefit of all in this community for close to 50 years would benefit no one. There is no state interest in doing so. I understand that this type of law has been struck down in other states, but quite frankly, we are not New York State, we are not New Jersey, and we are not Maryland. I think here in this state, we believe in protecting the consumer. The consumer knows what to look for when they look for a kosher product. And I would say that Minnesota consumers recognize kosher as Orthodox Hebrew. It's been the standard. We've worked together on it for a very long time. It's good law. And the reason it's good law is because it recognizes the reality of the street, which is that the kosher consumer, the housewife, the house husband, whoever's doing the shopping, recognizes kosher as being Orthodox kosher. To change the law, to ignore the fact that it is 97% recognized that this is the standard of kosher that we adhere to in this state, would be changing something for no reason and to no benefit of the state. And I don't pick the number 97% out of thin air. I have with me a recent copy of Kashrus Magazine, which is a leading industry trade magazine, and it lists its 2004 listing of kosher agencies worldwide. There are 592 of them, and they list both Orthodox and non-Orthodox agencies. And of the 592, I counted a grand total of 18 that were not Orthodox. Many of you have come from farms or come from parts of the country where you've seen rabbis come through. We're right behind the USDA inspectors. We send our rabbis to all parts of the state to certify meat plants, dairy plants, egg plants, whatever it might be.
There's one now.
And and when we go out there, 100% of the time, the rabbis that you have met are Orthodox rabbis. I urge you, ladies and gentlemen, let this bill die the dignified death it deserves. If any action should be coming from this body, it would be to admonish our community to work out these issues within our own offices and not trouble your good offices with this particular bit of information.
Thank you. Do we have one more?
Yes.
Thank you very much. As brief as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will be as brief as possible. And in no way does the change of language in this bill affect the good work that Rabbi Goldberger and his committee undertake now. In no way is there any going to be any effect on him or his organization and in no way is anyone declaring what he does not part of the kashrus industry that all of us as Jews are committed to. I just want to say that it is important to note that every congregational rabbi in the state of Minnesota who is a member of the Minnesota Rabbinical Association, which represents close to 90% of the affiliated Jews in the state of Minnesota, would like the following statement to be heard. The Minnesota Rabbinical Assembly, the assembly of rabbis representing the broad spectrum of the Jewish community of Minnesota, fully endorses the proposed amendment to the Kashrut Bill. As Jews, we believe that how we eat and the food we eat is governed by Jewish tradition and is a holy act. What makes food kosher is based on a rich history of Jewish legal writing. Rabbis of different Jewish movements, and even within one particular movement, often differ on the standards of kashrut. Having the state decide which food is kosher or which rabbis have the authority to give kashrut supervision unnecessarily blurs the boundaries between church and state. Throughout Jewish history, individuals have relied on the authority of their rabbis or denominations to offer guidelines as to which kosher certification is reliable. Until recently, the Minneapolis Jewish community or the Minnesota Jewish community has turned to a kashrus council to provide those communal guidelines. Today, that body no longer serves as the sole voice of kashrut certification in the state. The decision of the MRA to endorse the kashrut bill should not be understood to, nor is it intended to delegitimize any particular Jewish denomination. Instead, we hope that the proposed amendment will provide an opportunity for the entire Jewish community to comply with state law by removing the state from a religious matter and allowing each rabbi to determine the standards of kashrut appropriate for his or her community. To put it in terms that you may understand, and with this I conclude, it would be the same as if the state now mandated that the Lutheran hymnal used in Lutheran churches be that of the Missouri Synod, or that the hot dishes brought to Lutheran churches be approved only by the Wisconsin Synod. Every pulpit rabbi who is a member of the MRA endorses the change in this law to allow for Rabbi Goldberger and his organization to continue to certify for his community and to allow for kashrut to be removed from the entanglement with the Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And could you state your name for the record and who you represent?
I'm Rabbi Morris Allen. I'm the rabbi of Beth Jacob Congregation in Mendota Heights.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I know there's another committee that I think is starting to filter in here, but Representative Heigerken, would you want to renew your motion? Or Representative Hornstein, do you need to add anything?
No,
go ahead.
No.
All right. Yeah, no,
I
didn't.
I renewed
Okay.
I renew the motion.
Representative Heigerken renews the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. And members, with that, I'll adjourn the meeting. I would also say this. I'm not sure if we're going to have any more meetings. As you all know, deadline is Friday. I saw there was two or three bills that were in the bill introductions today. I need to probably check through things and to see if I need to call a meeting tomorrow or Friday, but it's possible that this might be our last meeting. And if so, I want to thank you all for cooperating and working with me, and like I said, there's possibility we have. There's also a possibility that next week we might have an informational meeting on an item or two. But thank you all.